Okay, well, we are near the end of the book of Ezekiel. Chapters 40 through 48 are talking about the new temple, the new worship in the millennial reign, the thousand-year reign, which comes after the seven-year tribulation period. We're waiting for the rapture. Poof, we're all gone. Then we have 7 years of watch the Left Behind movies, right? Now, people dealing without the Christians here, and we've got the Antichrist and all that horrible stuff that happens in the book of Revelation. And then Jesus comes back, and we have the thousand-year reign of Christ. And then the new heaven and new earth. So we're looking at the temple during the thousand-year reign of Christ. Quite interesting. Now, as I was studying, I came across Pastor Chuck's notes, and this is what he has to say. Of all the Bible and the passages in the Bible, I understand Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48 the least. I do not pretend to have a full and complete understanding of Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48. In fact, I have great difficulty with these passages. And because I do lack personally in an understanding of this section, I do find it extremely difficult to minister from this particular section of the scriptures. You know what? I agree with him. So, what we're going to look at is the new temple. Now, we have, how many temples do we see in the Bible? We have Solomon's temple, number one, right? And then they came back and they rebuilt the temple. We'll call that Zerubbabel's temple because he's the guy that laid the foundation and built it. But then Herod came along and remodeled it and enlarged it. So there's number three. And that's the temple that Jesus came back to. And then we have the present day temple is where? In us. That'd be four. Then we have the temple in the tribulation period that the Antichrist comes and we see the abomination that causes desolation standing in the holy place. So that's how many? Five. Then we have the one we're going to study today during the millennial reign. And then we have the new heaven and the new earth and the new Jerusalem coming down, and we'll count that as a temple. So there's seven of them. Trivia, no application for you on that. So, to understand this new temple, we have to take a look at the context. Ezekiel is a captive in Babylon, and all the remnant of the Jewish nation is there in Babylon as a captive. They have no temple. They have no country. They don't have a king anymore. It looks bleak. Are we going to ever be a country again? And God gives them Ezekiel's writings, gave them Jeremiah's writings, and as we're going through, he says, I'm going to make a new covenant with you, a covenant of peace. I'm going to bring you all back into the land. Really? But we're captives here in Babylon. Really? Is that possible? Oh, yeah. From all the nations, I'm going to bring you all back. And we saw that begin to happen in 1948. And then he says, not only that, I'm going to remove all of the foreign nations from your land. And we saw that, the last guy, Ezekiel 38, 39, the last people to try and invade the land. And so they're kind of getting encouraged. Wow, Lord, really? We're going to be back in the land and you're going to remove the foreign nations? But you know, we've been lousy in our worship of you. We polluted the temple, we put idols in the temple, and you judged us rightfully. Well, we're going to have a new relationship, you guys. I'm going to even show you the new temple that you're going to be worshiping me in. Wow. Now, as we're going to read, he goes into great detail. I mean, how many steps are in this entry? And, you know, why would he do that? Why would he go into such detail? There's going to be palm trees over carved over here and all these little details. Because what they're looking at is, we don't have a temple. We don't have a relationship with you right now or a place to go worship you right now. But you're describing what we're going to get to go back to. Full, complete relationship with you, Lord. You're going to restore us, even though we went totally sideways on you. Can you imagine what an encouragement that would have been to those in Babylon? Okay, so we're going to take a look at that. Now, there are some issues. As we look at the new temple that's going to be built during the millennial reign, there's animal sacrifice. Does that make you wrinkle your forehead? Why would there be animal sacrifice again? Wasn't Jesus our perfect once-for-all sacrifice? Yeah. So as Christians, we have trouble with that. So what's the answer, Roger? Well, I can only suggest some things. I'm puzzled by this one. And I think that's why Pastor Chuck is puzzled. The purpose of animal sacrifices was to teach us about sin. Agreed? Listen to Hebrews. I'm in chapter 10. For the law, having a shadow of the good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never, with these same sacrifices, which they offer continually, year by year, make those who approach perfect. So during the millennial reign, if they do animal sacrifices, it can't make them perfect. It can't take away their sin, can it? So what's the purpose for it? It goes on to say, for then they would not have ceased to be offered. For the worshipers, once purified, would have had no more consciousness of sins. But in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins every year. So the sacrifices point out our sin. If they're doing animal sacrifices in the millennial reign, the only thing that makes sense to me is that it's reminding us of our sin that Jesus paid for. It could also be a remembrance. We celebrate communion. That's a remembrance of Jesus dying and being broken. So are they doing these animal sacrifices as a remembrance of their sin and Jesus taking care of their sin? It's just some suggested thoughts for you. I don't have the answer for you today on that. That's a puzzle. But God does promise a new relationship in Hebrews chapter 10 as it goes on. This is the covenant that I will make with them after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws into their hearts, and their minds I will write them. Then he adds, their sins and their lawless deeds I will remember no more. Now where there is remission of these, there is no longer an offering for sin. Does that sound familiar? He was quoting Jeremiah. Remember what Jeremiah's purpose was? He was warning the Israelites before King Nebuchadnezzar came and captured them and hauled them away to Babylon. And he wrote this. Now Ezekiel, in Babylon at the same time, wrote, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes. And you will keep my judgments and do them. Pretty neat. Pretty neat promises to this people as they're captured in Babylon. And so as I read this, it just raises the question to me even more. Why are we doing animal sacrifices then, Lord, in the millennial reign? I think he's just showing them, I'm going to reestablish that relationship and it's going to be perfect with you guys. Now, the temple is in relationship to the Israelites during the millennial reign, not with the Gentiles. Isn't that interesting? Yet the nations go to Jerusalem to worship the Lord. So we've got an interesting picture of the millennial reign. So let's pick it up in chapter 40, verse 1. In the 25th year of our captivity, that would be 573 BC, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was captured, on the very same day, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he took me there. In the visions of God, he took me into the land of Israel and set me on a very high mountain. On it toward the south was something like the structure of a city. So this prophecy is communicated to Ezekiel in a vision. And God, in the vision, transports him to the top of a high mountain. But he's also transporting Ezekiel into the future because he's going to look at the millennial reign. Now, today, this high mountain doesn't exist. He's on this high mountain overlooking Jerusalem. I mean, the only mountain around there that's higher is the Mount of Olives. But he would have described that as the Mount of Olives. So he's on some new high mountain that's there north of Israel. Verse 3, he took me there and beheld there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of bronze. He had a line of flax and a measuring rod in his hand, and he stood in the gateway. So I'm going to translate that to, I saw this man of bronze, and he was a construction worker, and he had a plumb bob and a tape measure. And the man said to me, Son of man, look with your eyes and hear with your ears and fix your mind on everything I show you. I interpret that as pay attention to what I'm going to show you now. For you were brought here so that I might show them to you. Declare to the house of Israel everything you see. So he's to pay attention. And he's going to declare this to the captives. Since he wrote it down, he's also declaring it to us. Pretty cool. Verse 5. Now there was a wall all around the outside of the temple. In the man's hand was a measuring rod, 6 cubits long, each being a cubit and a handbreadth. And he measured the width of the wall structure, 1 rod, and the height, 1 rod. Now, a cubit is that, about 18 inches. The problem with this measurement that we're going to look at today is if I put my cubit up next to one of your cubits, they're all going to be different, aren't they? But this is they call it a royal cubit, because you do that and you do that. So now that's the cubit that they're talking about. So 18 plus 3, some people say since it's a handbreadth, you do it like that. So that 18 plus 6 would be 24 inches. Let's use that today, because we're going to look at a lot of numbers, and 24 is easy to turn into feet, because we just double it. If he says, you know, 1 cubit, it's 2 feet. So he measures the wall around the outside of the temple, and it says it's 1 rod thick and 1 rod high. Now a rod is 6 cubits, so our cubit is 2 feet. So how long is a rod? 12 feet. So this wall is 12 feet high and 12 feet thick. Others, if they just do the handbreadth like that, it's 21 inches. And so a rod would be 10 and a half feet. But I don't think that matters with our application. Verse 6, then he went, let's see, go ahead and put up slide 1, would you, Paul? Let me see if this guy will work. Look at that. Okay, so he's measuring the wall around the temple. And we're going to look at the details of this temple. I know it's kind of hard to read out there. I'll try to point out the different things, but we'll leave this up for a little while. Verse 6. Then he went to the gateway which faced east. So that would be this gate right here. And he's going to describe the measurements of the gate. Go ahead and go to slide 2, Paul, would you? And he went up its stairs and measured the threshold of the gateway, which was 1 rod wide. And the other threshold was 1 rod wide. What he's doing is he's measuring these ends here. So I think it's 6 feet and 6 feet right there. That's how thick the wall is. Verse 7, each gate chamber was 1 rod long and 1 rod wide. Between the gate chambers was a space of 5 cubits, that'd be 10 feet. And the threshold of the gateway by the vestibule of the inside gate was 1 rod, or 12 feet. No, that'd be 6 feet, wouldn't it? He also measured the vestibule of the inside gate, 1 rod. Then he measured the vestibule of the gateway, 8 cubits. And the gateposts, 2 cubits. The vestibule of the gate was on the inside. In the eastern gateway, there were 3 gate chambers on one side and 3 on the other. The 3 were all the same size. Also, the gateposts were of the same size on this side and that side. He measured the width of the entrance to the gateway, 10 cubits, and the length of the gate, 13 cubits. There was a space in front of the gate chambers, 1 cubit on this side and 1 cubit on that side. The gate chambers were 6 cubits on this side and 6 cubits on that side. Then he measured the gateway from the roof of 1 gate chamber to the roof of the other. The width was 25 cubits, that'd be 50 feet. As door faces door, he measured the gateposts 60 cubits high. Wow, 120 feet high. And the court all around the gateway extended to the gateposts. From the front of the entrance gate to the front of the vestibule of the inner gate was 50 cubits. I know that no one is confused yet, right? Verse 16. There were beveled window frames on the gate chambers and in their intervening archways on the inside of the gateway all around and likewise in the vestibules. There were windows all around on the inside and on each gatepost were palm trees.
Wow.
So he described, see all the numbers here, he describes everything. The width here, how big this chamber is, how long the whole thing is. You got a bigger vestibule over here on your way out. So this is the gate to come into the city. This is really typical. They found gates built by Solomon. They're almost identical to this. And what you would have is, you want to come into the city, so you're going to walk up the gate and you're going to have guards in here. They're going to check you out before they let you in the city. The other thing that happened at the gates was business. Remember Boaz, and he wanted to marry Ruth? And he went to the gate because the guy was there that was really next in line to inherit the land that Naomi, her husband, had owned. And so Boaz goes there and says, hey, do you want this land? Oh, yeah, I'll take that land. He says, oh, by the way, if you take it, you've got to marry Ruth. Oh, you take it. So Boaz, okay, and he had to take a sandal off and give it to the guy, you know, as a symbol of obeying the laws of Leviticus. And so he did all that business in the gate and married Ruth. Cool story. So that's what the gates are for. Now, why would he describe this gate in such detail to the captives in Babylon? Communicates to me as a captive, he must really mean this. Look at the detail he's talking about. He has really designed what this gate's going to be like exactly. This temple is going to be built, apparently. It just underlines that this is really going to happen. Now, there are two other gates like this, as we're going to read. Let's go to verse 17, back to slide 1, Paul. Then he brought me into the outer court, and there were chambers and a pavement made all around. The court, 30 chambers, faced the pavement. The pavement was by the side of the gateways, corresponding to the length of the gateways. This was the lower pavement. Then he measured the width from the front of the lower gateway to the front of the inner court exterior, 100 cubits toward the east and the north. Now this seems really confusing. How many construction workers do we have in here? How many of you have tried to read architects' plans? Are they any clearer than this? Sometimes they're worse. Anyhow, he's measuring, this is the courtyard here. And he's measuring 100 cubits and 100 cubits like that. These are the chambers all the way around. We're going to see another gate here. It's identical to that one. And another gate here. It's identical to that one. And then we have three more gates. Here's the temple. Here's the altar where they do the offerings. So if you were coming into the temple to bring an offering, you might come through the gate, come through the next gate, bring your offering, they'd burn it. And of course you have the holy place in here and the Holy of Holies where the Ark of the Covenant used to be. And so he's going to talk about all the different buildings around here, which don't mean that much to us, but they make sense to the Israelites. And so because they don't mean that much to us, I'm going to let you read some of the details yourself. If you want to know exactly how many stairs or how wide that gatepost was, you can study it. Verse 20, the northern gateway. On the outer court was also a gateway facing north. This one here. And he measured its length and its width, its gate chambers, three on this side and three on that side, its gate posts and its archways had the same measurement as the first gate. So we'll move to the next one, the next gate. In verse 24, he describes this, the southern gate, and he'll say in verse 24, according to the same measurements as the first gate. So we don't need to read all that again. Now in the old days, in the old temples, there were four gates. There's only three in this one. Three points of access to God. What bell goes off in your head? The Trinity, yeah. Hey, works for me. Pretty cool. Then we look at the south inner gate. So that's this one right here. And he's going to describe it, and then guess what? These are built exactly the same. Then he brought me to the inner court through the southern gateway. He measured the southern gateway according to the same measurements. So it's just like the outer gateways, same size. But down in verse 31, we have some new information. Its archways faced the outer court, palm trees were on its gateposts, and going up to it were 8 steps instead of 7 steps. So verse 32 describes the east inner gate, and then we have the north inner gate at verse 35. So we can jump down to verse 38. There was a chamber and its entrance by the gateposts of the gateway, where they washed the burnt offering. In the vestibule of the gateway were 2 tables on this side and 2 tables on that side, on which to slay the burnt offering, the sin offering, and the trespass offering. At the other side of the vestibule, as one goes up to the entrance of the northern gateway, were 2 tables, and on the other side of the vestibule of the gateway were 2 tables. 4 tables were on this side and 4 tables on that side, by the side of the gateway, 8 tables on which they slaughtered the sacrifices. There were also 4 tables of hewn stone for the burnt offering, 1 cubit and a half long, 1 cubit and a half wide, and 1 cubit high. On these they laid the instruments with which they slaughtered the burnt offering and the sacrifice. Inside were hooks a handbreadth wide, fastened all around, and the flesh of the sacrifices was on the tables. So what we're reading here is where they're going to slaughter the animals when they bring them in. They describe up here, see the 2 T's? That is where they think these tables were, also inside there. But they're not really sure. In all the sources I looked at, no one really knows. Except that they know they're up here by the northern gate. Now they also might be duplicated by these gates. One thing that crosses my mind is in the old temple, you had the sheep gate, which was up here. And that's where you would bring in the animals to sacrifice. And so perhaps they only did this on the north gate. Maybe that's why the north gate is described. But we're for certain going to have animal sacrifices, aren't we? They've got all the tools and instruments and the tables there. Verse 44. Outside the inner gate were the chambers for the singers in the inner court. Now if you look on this, we have the singers, you see the little rooms right there. So you bring in your sacrifice, and it's going to be burnt here, and you've got the singers there worshiping the Lord. Kind of cool. You got the pleasing aroma coming up from the altar. The singers are there, and your heart is just, let's say you're doing a peace offering where you're celebrating the peace you have with the Lord because you're forgiven, and you have a relationship with him, and the singers are there, and Jim's there with his guitar, singing, oh, na, 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 sacrifice, you know. It'd be cool. Outside the inner gate were the chambers for the singers in the inner court, one facing south at the side of the northern gateway, and the other facing north at the side of the southern gateway. So we have them on both sides, apparently. Then he said to me, this chamber which faces south is for the priests who have charge of the temple. The chamber which faces north is for the priests who have charge of the altar. These are the sons of Zadok, from the sons of Levi, who come near the Lord to minister to him. Now, this Zadok was a high priest, and he remained loyal to King David when Absalom was rebelling against him. Remember, the kingdom was dividing. And well, Absalom lost, and Zadok remained loyal to David, the true king. And then his sons, his descendants, also remained loyal while Israel went sideways and started idol worship. But his son stayed true to the Lord. And so the descendants of Zadok are ministering in this new temple. Verse 47, and he measured the court, talk about the inner court here, 100 cubits long and 100 cubits wide, 4 square. The altar was in front of the temple. Then he brought me to the vestibule of the temple and measured the doorposts of the vestibule, 5 cubits on this side and 5 cubits on that side. So he's talking about in here. Here's the inner court. It's 100 cubits by 100 cubits. So how big is that? 200 feet by 200 feet. It's pretty big, isn't it? And then you've got the altar right in the middle. And here's the entrance to the temple. And you have a vestibule. If we had one at this church, that's where we'd be hanging our coats. And then you go into the holy place. What typically would be in the holy place, you guys? Colin, hush, because you know. I want everybody to think. What did I hear? There you go. So you walk in. On the left-hand side is the menorah, and it has the seven lamps that are filled with oil, which represents the Holy Spirit. And then you lay the wick in there, and you've got the light. That's the only source of light in there. And, of course, you've got the Holy Spirit shedding light on the room. Hey, that makes sense. On the other side, you have the table of showbread, which was 12 loaves, which represents 12 tribes of Israel, God's people. So you've got God's light from the Holy Spirit shining upon God's people. And then right in front, before the veil, you have the altar of incense, which is burning, and the smoke is drifting in through the veil into the holy place where God's presence was. And that represents the prayers of God's people. So it's all illustration as you walk in there. So here's the holy place, and then the Holy of Holies, that's where the Ark of the Covenant was, Indiana Jones. And you've got the cherub there with the wings over it, and you got the mercy seat, and that's where God's Shekinah glory would dwell. And the priest could only go in there once a year to make offering for the people. So that's the significance of the temple. Now let's look at how this one is designed. So he said five cubits on this side and 5 cubits on that side. He's talking about the doorposts. These are big doorposts. And the width of the gateway was 3 cubits on this side and 3 cubits on that side. So we've got 6-foot thick door jams. The length of the vestibule was 20 cubits, which would be 40 feet, and the width, 11 cubits. So we got a 22-foot opening. And by the steps which led up to it, there were pillars by the doorposts, one on this side and another on that side. So as we're going into the temple, we're walking upstairs, and then we come here, and we walk up some more stairs, and we come in here, we walk up some more stairs, going to the holy place. So it just keeps rising in elevation. Chapter 41. Then he brought me into the sanctuary and measured the doorposts, 6 cubits wide on one side and 6 cubits wide on the other side. The width of the tabernacle, which was 12 cubits or 24 feet. So now he's in the holy place. The width of the entry was 10 cubits, and the side walls of the entrance were 5 cubits on this side and 5 cubits on the other side. And he measured its length, 40 cubits, and its width, 20 cubits. So we've got an 80 by 40 foot room. It's pretty big. This room here is about 30 by 50. So this holy place right here was a little bigger than our sanctuary. Now he's going to go into the Holy of Holies, that little next room. Also, he went inside and measured the doorposts, 2 cubits, and the entrance, 6 cubits high, and the width of the entrance, 7 cubits. He measured the length, 20 cubits, and the width, 20 cubits, beyond the sanctuary. And he said to me, "This is the most holy place." Next, he measured the wall of the temple. Go to slide 3, if you would. 6 cubits. The width of each side chamber all around the temple was 4 cubits on every side. The side chambers were in 3 stories, one above the other. So now he's talking about outside the temple area. This is an elevation. So here's the holy place, the doorway going in. But you go in, and on each side, there's little rooms on each side. And they're stacked. They're 3 stories high. And they get larger as you go up. Here's the attic area. And we're going to talk about the outer wall. Okay? The side chambers were in 3 stories, one above the other, 30 chambers in each story. Wow. 30 chambers in each story, so that's 90 chambers all total. They rested on ledges which were for the side chambers all around, that they might be supported but not fastened to the wall of the temple. As one went up from story to story, the side chambers became wider all around, because their supporting ledges in the wall of the temple ascended like steps. Therefore, the width of the structure increased as one went up from the lowest story to the highest by way of the middle one. I also saw an elevation all around the temple. It was the foundation of the side chambers, a full rod that is 6 cubits high. The thickness of the outer wall of the side chambers was 5 cubits, and so also the remaining terrace by the place of the side chambers of the temple. And between it and the wall chambers was a width of 20 cubits all around the temple on every side. The doors of the side chambers opened on the terrace, one door toward the north and another toward the south. And the width of the terrace was 5 cubits all around. So just your eyes begin to glaze over as you read this. And guys have studied it and tried to come up with what they think it really was describing. So we have this big foundation that it's all on. Probably do it out of a big stone or something. But you've got these rooms here and you kind of have a porch. I don't have a big significant spiritual application for you on this. Except that God is talking to the captives that don't have a temple, don't have a country. This has to seem marvelous to them. And so he's showing his grace. You're going to be back in relationship with me. You know, he had just shown them the valley of dry bones. Are you able to be brought back as a nation? This huge valley of just dead bones, and he brings them all back and reattaches the muscle and the sinews and breathes life into them. He breathed life into Israel and created them as a nation again, and now he's showing them the sanctuary they're going to worship in. What did he do to us? We were dead in sin, and he saved us and breathed life into us, even though we were sinners, and now we have the sanctuary inside us and we're worshiping him. It's the same pattern. God restores his people into relationship with him, even though we've gone sideways on him. Verse 12, the building that faced the separating courtyard at its western end was 70 cubits wide. The wall of the building was 5 cubits thick all around, and its length 90 cubits. We're talking about this over here. No, back to slide one, I'm sorry. Thank you. This one over here, where there's no gate, this building. The building of separation, right here. Now, we're going to do a recap starting in verse 13. So he measured the temple, and he's measuring the courtyard again. And he, 100 cubits long, and the separating courtyard with the building in its walls was 100 cubits long. So he's recapping all the measurements that he did. And I can get you a copy of this slide if you'd like behind me, and you can study it. Verse 18, and it, he's talking about outside the temple, talking about that wall, was made with cherubim and palm trees, a palm tree between cherub and cherub. Each cherub had two faces, so that the face of a man was toward a palm tree on one side, and the face of a young lion toward a palm tree on the other side. Thus it was made throughout the temple all around, from the floor to the space above the door, and on the wall of the sanctuary, cherubim and palm trees were carved. And then he gives more detail on the temple, verses 21 through 26, beveled windows and so forth. I'll let you read that. In chapter 42, he talks about the priest chambers, which are out around here. Priest chambers right there. And this is kind of interesting. In verse 13, then he said to me, the north chambers and the south chambers, which are opposite the separating courtyard, are the holy chambers where the priests who approach the Lord shall eat the most holy offerings. There they shall lay or store the most holy offerings, the grain offering, the sin offering, and the trespass offering, for the place is holy. When the priests enter them, they shall not go out of the holy chamber into the outer court, but there they shall leave their garments in which they minister, for they are holy. They shall put on other garments, then they may approach that which is for the people. So, let's say you're doing a fellowship offering. The idea was you'd offer an animal. Some of the meat would go on the altar. That was the Lord's portion, and be totally burned up. You can smell the aroma. Some of the meat would go to the priest, be cooked, and he would eat it. And then you, with your family, would sit down there by the temple and eat your portion. And so the idea is you're having dinner with God and the priest. God's getting his portion, you're eating your portion, and the priest is eating his portion, and it's fellowship. You're celebrating that fellowship you have with the Lord. And so there's where the priests were to eat their portions. Verse 15. Now when he had finished measuring the inner temple, he brought me out through the gateway that faces toward the east and measured it all around. He measured the east side with the measuring rod. Oh, now he's measuring the outside wall of the whole temple. He measured the east side with the measuring rod, 500 rods by the measuring rod all around. He measured the north side, 500 rods by the measuring rod all around. He measured the south side, 500 rods by the measuring rod. He came around to the west side and measured 500 rods by the measuring rod. He measured it on the four sides. It had a wall all around, 500 cubits long and 500 wide, to separate the holy areas from the common. Now, this math, if you look at it closely, doesn't really add up. 500 rods times 12 feet, help me, you mathematicians. How many? 6,000. More than a mile. 1,000 cubits, 1,000 cubits, 1,000 cubits, 1,000. That's too long. Now, other translations say 500 cubits, but measured by the rod. So I'm going to measure feet, but I'm going to use a yardstick to measure. I think that's the correct interpretation. And that comes out to be 1,000 feet, about 1,000 feet long. And that kind of makes sense. Now, I have told you that the temple area won't fit on the Temple Mount as it stands today. If we measure it by 500 rods, it's 6,000 feet long, it won't fit on the Temple Mount today. If we measure it by 500 cubits, it will. I've always assumed, until I did this study, that God's got to shake the earth and make the Temple Mount bigger so that the new temple will fit on it. So it depends on how or what these measurements really are. We are going to stop there, because in chapter 43, we start to look at the ministry of the priests. It's a good stopping point, and I'm 50 minutes here. So again, you guys can see why I say I don't have a real big spiritual implication. But the thing is, it's going to happen. Look at all the prophecies in Ezekiel that have come true to the letter up to this point. And he has, at this point, earned the captives respect that, you know what, this guy, what he says comes true. And so now we have this a little bit bizarre description of a temple. It's going to come through. And look at the detail he's showing. I think the detail underscores, again, it's going to be built. It's not just some spiritual illustration or application. Why would you care about how many steps are going up there if it's just a spiritual application? It's going to be built as it's written there.